Welcome to the 8th episode of the Global History Podcast, which is also the next installment in our series on global histories of health, medicine, and disease in the early modern world. I'm Chase, and I'll be your host for today's segment. Today, I'd like to welcome Nukit Varlick, Associate Professor in the Faculty of History at Rutgers University Newark. In her own words, Dr. Varlick is a historian of the Ottoman Empire with a keen interest in disease, medicine, and other traditions of healing and public health. She is the author of Plague and Empire in the Early Modern Mediterranean World, The Ottoman Experience, 1347 to 1600, as well as the editor of the collected volume Plague and Contagion in the Islamic Mediterranean, New Histories of Disease in Ottoman Society. Her current monograph project is tentatively titled The Ottoman Healing Arts, Healers, Patients, and the State in the Early Modern Era. Last Friday, I spoke with Professor Varlick over Skype about her research on plague, healing, and public health in the early modern Ottoman Empire, and we discussed topics including the importance of considering the Ottoman experience in the broader history of plague, the links between Ottoman imperial expansion and the spread of plague, as well as practices of healing in early modern Ottoman society. Listen on to find out more. And, as always, if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com, or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. If you'd like to listen to the other episodes in this series on global histories of health, medicine, and disease in the early modern world, head over to our website at theglobalhistorypodcast.com, or look for the series playlist on Spotify. And just a note to say that if you're listening to this on our website, we're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts if you prefer to listen on one of those platforms. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Professor Varlick. It's a wonderful opportunity to get to read your work, and I'm excited to learn a bit more about plague in the Ottoman Empire.
Thank you for inviting me on the podcast.
Yes, of course. So to start off, I'd like to think broadly and to speak about the general historiographical treatment of the Ottoman experience of plague. So the disease caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, if I'm correct on that. So in your book, Plague and Empire in the Early Modern Mediterranean World, you identify two overarching issues with existing historiography, among other issues as well, which is that, one, you believe that Ottoman specialists have not taken plague seriously enough in their writing of histories of the Ottoman world, and then second, that non-Ottomanists, and particularly those working on plague in Europe, have not really considered enough the Ottoman experience of plague in their own analysis. So I was wondering if you could walk me through these historiographical interventions you're making and why they're important.
Right. Okay. Thank you. It's a great question. And starting with the historiography, I guess hopefully will give us the general layout of the project that I was trying to accomplish in the first book, though I'm kind of taking it a little forward in the second book that I'm working on right now. So in my book, I basically made two main interventions to the historiography, not thinking of the Ottomanist and European scholarship of like of two different isolated and independent domains. I try to work with the idea of the second pandemic, that is to say the Black Death and the recurrent waves of the Black Death continuing over centuries across a very large geographic area. So what happens if we expand the temporal and spatial dimensions of the pandemic and see this as a continuous, as a large-scale phenomenon, and try to address the issues in the historiography from that perspective? So that was one of the main issues. But like looking more specifically on the Europeanist and the Ottomanist historiography, well, there are several issues. So first of all, in the Ottoman historiography, historians of the Ottoman Empire have treated Ottoman history, especially the early centuries of Ottoman history, and roughly speaking, I'm thinking about like 1300 to 1600 time frame, generally speaking. This is what we call the classical period of Ottoman history, right? So for that time period, scholars, modern historians of the Ottoman Empire have treated the history of the empire as if plague did not happen or did not have any impact, which is to say that plague is invisible. It's not a major actor when we think about Ottoman history. Plague only becomes an important actor in Ottoman history, according to contemporary historiography, after the 17th century. So it gives you this illusion, or this wrong idea, as if plague only started to affect the Ottoman Empire in the 18th century and then continued into the 19th, which is entirely false. Plague has a much longer history, and it is important to take into account that long history because we learn a lot in terms of social change, in terms of the epidemiological changes of the disease itself, but also where it sits in the larger history of plague in Western Eurasia, the Mediterranean world, Europe, North Africa, Middle East, and all that in that larger geography. So turning to the Europeanist historiography, and I understand it's not the job of European historians, historians of Europe to, you know, to understand the Ottoman sources. Of course, it is the task of, you know, Ottomanists to give that analysis to the Europeanists, but the Europeanists on that for on that end, for their part, they were happy to repeat and recycle older narratives of plague that they had inherited from the early modern into the modern historiography about, you know, certain misconceptions in the historiography that they brought and biases. So what was, you know, what is like the overarching bias? Well, it's the argument or the belief and then the notion and almost this established, you know, fact that plague comes from the Ottoman Empire to Europe, right? I mean, it is such an old and established, such a resilient idea that's very difficult to break. So I was kind of, you know, dealing with that issue in my research. But just generally speaking, So Europeanist historiography, first of all, gives this illusion that Europe was the only place in the world that was affected from the Black Death and its recurrent outbreak. So that's one issue. So if you only read Europeanist account of the Black Death, and that's the majority, the overwhelming majority of the scholarship, you get this illusion that plague only came to Europe and only killed Europeans. It, I mean, can't be far away from truth, right? It affected many parts of the Afro-Eurasian world, starting in the mid-14th century and then afterwards. In fact, I believe that you spoke with my colleague Monica Green recently, and her research, yeah, yeah, basically, and the research of others are now trying, helping us to restructure the chronology of the second pandemic. So it probably started earlier than we thought. So we're talking about like a multi-century phenomenon. So in that sense, well, if you read the scholarship, you get a sense of plague as something that only affected Europe. And at the same time, you get this illusion that it's something like a one-off. Right? I mean, Black Death comes, it kills, you know, one-third to two-thirds of European population and disappears. I mean, this is wrong, right? I mean, I know I'm not the only historian who's working on, you know, correcting this narrative, but we need to break this narrative that the Black Death is just a one-time phenomenon. It comes and then it goes away. So in on the contrary, we need to think of the long history of the second pandemic as like a series of outbreaks, as recurrences, as what I refer to it as a new plague regime, new disease regime, right? Something that lasts multiple centuries. And how do we think of a society's constant struggle with an ongoing trouble, ongoing disaster, right? So this disease is nowhere to go. It repeats itself. Bottom line, one of the major problems in Europeanist historiography was repeating older narratives. That plague comes from the East. The other narrative is like as if Black Death is an isolated incident. And the other, you know, major problem is that it's as if only Europe suffered from plague. So these were the main issues in the historiography that I was trying to address. And there are other issues as well that perhaps we can talk about later on. But the historiography really needed to be corrected in that sense. And I also tried to bring the Ottoman sources into dialogue with European sources in many ways, and perhaps we can get into that discussion later on. We can think of the Mediterranean, the larger Mediterranean world as a biological zone that kind of allowed the interaction of different biological entities and also circulation of disease pathogens, and as well as circulation of people, animal, and trade goods and whatnot. So those mobilities are something that help us understand the larger Mediterranean world as biologically unified. In fact, you know, historian Emmanuel de la Douille, you know, talked about this. He proposed this idea, and other historians have also expanded on this idea later on. So I'm not the first one to say this, but I think it is something helpful to think about the larger Mediterranean world as a unified entity in a biological sense, as much as we understand in perhaps in other meanings, to think about one region within that larger world, and looking at their plague experience, just thinking about it as, you know, in terms of connections and interactions. So that's what I was trying to do mainly.
That's really fascinating. Thank you. Thank you for introducing the topic to us through the historiography. So you mentioned sources, and I'm quite interested to get a bit into that. Mm-hmm. So what are the main historical sources, well, actually, historical and scientific sources, I suppose, that we have to study plague outbreaks in the Ottoman world? And what types of different perspectives can using these different types of sources offer us in historical analyses?
Right. And again, yes, there are multiple sources that we can talk about, both textual and non-textual, in as far as Ottoman history goes, and also, you know, for other studying plague, history of plague in other parts of the world. But I should probably clarify that the number and genre and type of sources that we have for Ottoman history is not a uniform continuity across centuries. First of all, let's just remember the number of written textual sources from the 14th century and the first half of the 15th century is extremely limited. It's not like there is nothing that was written, but very, very small number of texts. So that's one challenge, right? Starting in the second half of the 15th century and into the 16th century and later, we see an exponential growth in the number of sources. And that's not only historical, narrative, documentary, or archival sources, but all terms, all sorts of sources, including medical, legal, social, cultural, religious, in all domains of life in Ottoman history. So sources kind of show a trend from like fewer sources to more sources, right? And as in terms of numbers, but it also in terms of the subject matter they cover, in terms of detail you can gather from them, they're from like, you know, less detailed to more detailed. So that's one thing to keep in mind. If you're trying to understand the history of plague in that succession of sources, it is obvious that you're not going to find as much in the earlier period as you do in the later period. And again, you know, earlier, later, I'm just working here with the time frame that I worked on the first book, from the mid 14th century to the end of the 16th century. So when I say early, late, so that's, you know, the time frame I have in mind. I can get a little bit into the later time period, into like post 17th century, but for the time being, let's stick with this time frame. So sources change. And that also means our understanding of, or our knowledge of, our capability of documenting the occurrence of plague is also something that changes, right? In perhaps the 14th and early 15th century sources, you have occasional references to plague, that you have this vague idea that the disease occurred, and perhaps some specific references to the death of certain individuals, very prominent individuals, but really nothing much, nothing detailed, right? And perhaps you can get the emotional tone of the, you know, the experience of plague and the experience of losing your family members and loved ones and your children in some cases, that's as we have from some poems, to plague. So you can get that tone, but nothing that would be specific enough to say, you know, plague occurred in this city on this day, you know, or like killed so many people. So that's not the kind of information that you have from written sources in the earlier period. As we move into the late 15th and 16th century, you have much more detailed sources. And then you also have in the second half of the 16th century, systematic development of systematic record keeping. that kind of, you know, forms the eventually forms the Ottoman state archives that we have mass historians access to today, that we can draw documents from and study, among other things, the history of plague. So you have very detailed information, you know, in the second half of the 16th century from archival documents, but also from chronicles and other sources. Plague occurs in this, you know, on this date, to the day, right? And like, you know, kills this many number of people, it did this, that. So all sorts of problems from not even only like big urban areas in the capital, but also from like remote villages and very, you know, off the chart places. So we get to learn about the experience of a plague of those remote rural communities. So the sources are more detailed. But overall, most sources are textual sources. And that has some limitations. So part of the problem is for the early period when there is no detailed information and very few sources in general, it's very difficult to put together a coherent, detailed narrative about plague's history. And that is something that can be complemented by integrating sources from other historical traditions. For instance, Byzantine sources can be used to complement Ottoman sources, or, you know, Florentine, Venetian, Genoese sources, Mamluk sources. You have all these records and historical sources and, you know, travelers, visitors, you know, all forms of record keeping going on from other societies, from archives that survived. So it's possible to at least balance that absence of evidence with what we know from other societies. On the other hand, when you move into the later centuries, when there is an abundance of information, well, then there is also the difficulty of how to put different genres of sources in a dialogue with each other, right? Perhaps you're dealing with literary sources, and those give you perhaps a more exaggerated sense of the outbreak. Perhaps it's different from the narratives that you get from the state's point of view, from archival documents, right? So that's one challenge. And also they kind of, you know, talk about different aspects of this phenomenon, right? So you don't get a holistic picture by reading only one genre of sources. So I think part of the challenge for me was to gather information about plague from different genres and try to put them into dialogue with each other. So again, but mostly these are, of course, written textual sources. But as a historian of plague, I know that it's very valuable to go beyond textual evidence, try to integrate material evidence, especially recent ancient DNA research is something that allows it to learn much more detailed information about the history of evolutionary history of Yersinia pestis and its evolution. And that is something that, of course, something, a field that I'm following very closely, but at the same time, we do not have surviving ancient DNA evidence from the part of the world that the Ottoman Empire ruled historically from in the pre-modern period. So most of the ancient DNA knowledge that we have today about Yersinia pestis, most of it comes from Europe, right? I mean, it's still, you know, extremely valuable to put together a narrative of the history of the disease, but it's not specific enough to make assertions about the Ottoman Empire itself. But in the big picture, it is possible to make some broad observations within that general picture. So it's very useful. I wish there was a little more to develop a more solid basis for Ottoman history.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And it's a very quickly moving field as well. So I'm sure many, many, many new discoveries will be made very quickly.
Hopefully.
So one of your major arguments in the book is this intertwining of imperial growth of the Ottomans and the expansion of plague epidemics. And I'd like to take a closer look at some of the major reasons behind that. So some of the reasons you look at are conquest, urbanization, and the kind of spatialization of plague. Mm. And administration and trade. So I was wondering if you could speak about each of these, and essentially painting a picture of how this imperial growth really impacted the spread of plague.
Right. I mean, I think there's a very close connection between the two. And if we were to study the history of the empire without the plague, or the history of plague without the empire, we would really be missing out a lot. So I think that relationship, that entwinement, is very important to keep in mind, because, as I said, you know, we can't tell the story of one without the other. We really need that that dynamic historical interaction. Why? It's because we know that plague as a disease entity, but also as a social contract, you know, as a pandemic, our understanding of it is something that changes over time. Good. This is something that we can verify with paleogenetics evidence. You know, there's change, biologically speaking, though slow. Yes, but socially speaking, we also know that there's change. So we know that there are like changes in the epidemiological patterns of the disease, its mortality and whatnot. So there's change in terms of biological character of the disease. But there is also change in society. And so diseases are not these, you know, abstract entities that are uniform across time and space. They actually take the form of a society they affect, like they hit, and they kind of are affected by that society, by the structures, by its shortcomings, by its strengths, by its physical, you know, geography, by its climate. So there are the mobility of individuals. So there are all sorts of factors within a society that shape the disease. So, but looking at Ottoman history, and again, from 1347 to 1600, that's an incredibly fast pace change, time period of change in Ottoman history. It's not as if we're talking about a society that's just experiencing plague without changing, right? There are extremely important changes taking place, one of which being we're talking about the physical expansion of the territories of what was in the mid-14th century a small regional principality in Anatolia, to in the second half of the 16th century to a world empire, right, across three continents. So how can we understand the history of plague without looking at that expansion? What does it mean to think of Ottoman history in that dynamic, you know, phase of expansion, and how can we situate plague in it? So that was, you know, for me, one of the major challenges of trying to understand that relationship. But at the same time, it's not only, yes, you know, conquest, I talk a lot about it in the book, it's kind of expansion, yes, but at the same time, that's not the only factor. As the territories of the empire expanded, there is now a new effort to connect those different areas with each other in a way that wasn't before. So in that sense, like what the empire was trying to do, and it was a very conscious effort, right? We're talking about a centralized and centralizing empire. So it's not the political idea of centralizing on mobilization of resources and whatnot, but in the physical day-to-day working of the empire, we're talking about a kind of mobility and a kind of, you know, increased sense of interaction between different parts of the empire that was never experienced before, right? So again, just to give you an example, so an outbreak in North Africa and an outbreak in, say, the Black Sea region, right? Just think of them as like two different outbreaks that have nothing to do with each other, let's just suppose, right? But now you have an empire that connects those areas through all sorts of its what I call plague networks, right? I mean, those could be commercial networks, those could be administrative, military, or all forms of other networks that created interaction and mobility between those areas. And in fact, I believe that those the mobilities that created interaction between different biologically diverse zones that even extended beyond Ottoman territories. And by which I mean once the Ottomans had access to the Persian Gulf, for example, and that trade goods, that everything was coming from the Persian, from the Indian Ocean, right? You are now putting in touch, you know, those elements, those biological entities, in touch with something, well, that could reach as far as like Southeast Europe, the Balkans, North, the Black Sea, Mediterranean, Anatolia, North Africa. So it's a very, I mean, it's a broad area, but a very high level of mobility, I think, is what I think is significant. So that's one thing. The other thing is, as the empire was, you know, better connected and increased mobility, we see that plague now reaches places that it had not reached before, right? So the empire, in a way, was facilitating the spread of plague. Or you can think of plague as a byproduct of imperial expansion. But at the same time, it wasn't only expansion of territory, but also urbanization is another key factor, I believe. In the 16th century, you have, generally speaking, across the Mediterranean world, and this comes from like Braudel, other Anel school historians and others, just, you know, basically pointing out that the population is growing in the 16th century. There's like a very significant trend is in which you have the formation of new settlements, smaller settlements growing into larger cities and cities becoming, you know, even larger cities. So that's also something that we see in the Ottoman Empire. In particular, you know, we have clear examples of these urban and rural growth in an Ottoman Anatolia throughout the course of the 16th century. It's something that we need to explain. How is it possible to have an expanding, a growing population in a time where plague is a chronic problem, right? How can we explain this? It's kind of like, it's a little counterintuitive to think that, you know, on the one hand, you have something that's supposed to suppress the population, but at the same time, you have population growth. And I think the dynamic relationship between the two is something that can be explained through urbanization, because as plague affected the cities and killed, like each time a plague outbreak occurred in a major urban area and killed a certain percentage of the population living in the city, cities were in dire need of labor, of people who could do, you know, wage labor daily, day laborers. So they were always looking for like immigrants coming from the hinterland to take those jobs and to do those jobs, right? So there is kind of, you know, always an influx of incoming population to the cities only to basically lose their lives in the next outbreak. So, you know, as I mentioned before, outbreaks were occurring, you know, on a periodic basis every 10 to 15 years, in some cases less. So, yeah, there's like a cyclical aspect to that. So, but the cities could only maintain their population and expand their population by those coming from outside. And it's a classic phenomenon that economic historians explain. Of course, you know, when you have a shortage of labor in the cities, you know, as a result of plague and perhaps other reasons, and plague, you know, most prominently, you have, you know, people losing their lives in a very quick period of time, wages increase, there's increased demand for labor, and labor, so people migrate to the city. So conquest, urbanization, and all of these factors, and of course increased, you know, communication and trade between different parts of the empire, so the increased connectivity, I think all of these are the general structures in which we can understand the expansion of plague and the dynamic nature between plague and empire.
Now, what sorts of measures did Ottoman officials take to control the spread of disease? And do you think, is it possible to speak of a culture of public health in the early modern empire?
Right.
Or Ottoman Empire, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, yes, definitely yes. So that was, you know, one of the main points that I was trying to make and trying to understand. Well, okay, so we understand how the empire transformed the disease. It made it more widespread and whatnot. But at the same time, just looking at, you know, how the disease affected the society, how did the society respond to this? What were the measures taken? So when you look at all these, the effort to deal with this problem, right? To me, one of the most significant aspects of this struggle of dealing with disease, on the level of the state administration, you see this new, what I think is a new consciousness to make cities into cleaner places to protect the health of the population. And again, I want to emphasize that this is I mean, it's not an entirely new idea, but its implementation seems to be new during this time period. And, you know, other historians of late medieval period in Europe have written about this. And I was kind of expanding on that idea of the public health is something that, you know, in the historiography is something that we tend to associate with modernity, modern European cities. Like, you know, it's as if public health is a product of Western modernity, right? Again, that's a problem. Public health has a much older history. We see efforts in every society, in every time period, in, like, you know, ways of trying to clean the environment, but it becomes more systematic, in my opinion, at least in my research, that's what I argue, that becomes more systematic in the early modern period. And I think the Ottoman example is a very prominent example of this systematic effort, simply because Istanbul, the capital of the empire, and other major cities, you know, we talked about urbanization, growth of the cities, Istanbul was probably the largest city west of China, basically until the 17th century, right? So especially in the early modern period, Istanbul expanded beyond anything, you know, the population of any other city in the Mediterranean world. And again, just to give you some figures, at the time of the Ottoman conquest, 1453, from Byzantine Constantinople to Ottoman Istanbul, we're talking about a population of around, say, 50,000 people. Right. So by the middle of the 16th century, so within a year, within a century, within 100 years, we have at least tenfold expansion. So we're talking about in the mid 16th century, we're talking about a population of at least 500,000 people, if not more. And that number continues to increase. So there's, you know, fast population expansion, cities becoming, you know, more kind of mega cities in comparison to, I mean, at least Istanbul does, to anything else, during the same time period. And of course, you have more problems, right? When, like, more people live in a smaller city, you have more problems to regulating life and providing, well, dealing with crisis, providing for, the city population. And plague, you know, coming on top of this, you know, problem, of course, you have serious problems to deal with. So when I look at Ottoman history, especially late 15th and 16th century, Istanbul is a good model to see that change, that transformation. So, and yes, the Ottoman archival evidence kind of, you know, full of plenty of information to delineate this change. So the state administration is making an immense effort to take the dead outside of city walls. They are keeping an eye, a very close eye, on the numbers of individuals losing their life as a result of the outbreak. I don't know if they were making the curves, flatten the curve, probably not. But I have a feeling that they had a working knowledge of the different phases of the outbreaks, of the epidemics, like, you know, whether the numbers were expanding or shrinking. And also this has to do with the, you know, of course, with repeated outbreaks of plague, you have a sense of, you know, an experience of what it usually looks like, you know, at what time of year, at what season it starts, how it expands, how many people it kills every day. So all of these were, I think, very important metrics that they were aware of and they were using. It's not like you could stop the outbreak when it started, right? I mean, I don't think anywhere in the world, like before the modern period, we can talk about, you know, stopping the spread of an outbreak. But, you know, all the measures were for protection. I mean, there was, of course, treatment as well, but most of the public health efforts was aimed and targeted protection rather than treatment, right? Because, you know, prevention and protection from disease was deemed more important. So why were they removing dead bodies during plague outbreaks? Because they thought that the bodies of the plague infested individuals who died of plague was contagious. So they thought, you know, it is important to bury the dead as quickly as possible during plague outbreaks. But it's also interesting that this over time turns into standard measure. So then later on, they continued, like, even when there was no plague, they keep that regulation in the spirit of, you know, keeping the air clean. I mean, in the old tradition of Galenic medicine, of course, there's this idea that, you know, miasma, the contamination of the air, is something that affected the health of the population. So clean air, providing clean air in the city was one of the main important focus of the public health efforts. So they start building new cemeteries outside of city walls, which is, again, something that we need to pay attention to when you look at the history of cemeteries in the context of urban history. It's always described as if it's something that starts in 19th century Europe, right? I mean, also some in cities in the US, right? In 19th century, like Paris, London, and American cities are described as, well, they are the first to start this, like, you know, removing city cemeteries outside the main urban areas. I see the same effort in late 15th century Istanbul, and I think it's significant, right? But that's only one of the efforts. They were also trying to kind of, you know, keep the air of the city clean by removing businesses, some businesses outside of city walls, especially slaughterhouses, tanneries, and other businesses they thought were contaminating the air. So that's another effort. They were trying to make an effort to clean the cities, the streets, cleaning the streets and paving the streets, removing waste and other garbage and whatnot from the urban area. So, you know, again, all these are to have a clean air, right? Clean air. Clean water was also something that we see, especially in the 16th century, in the context of Istanbul and other major urban areas in the Ottoman Empire, something that we see being emphasized very heavily. Again, I mentioned for the case of Istanbul, we have a larger population now. How do you bring, you know, clean water for a larger population, but also how do you make sure that water is not contaminated, right? So I've seen in the Ottoman archives tons of documents about, like, you know, some houses or businesses that are too close to the aqueducts and waterways, and so whether they were contaminating water, tons of inspections, and sometimes they're destroyed or removed from the further away from the removal. So there is an effort to keep cities clean as part of the repertoire of precautions, you know, vis-a-vis the plague. And in addition to it, of course, we see, not at the level of straight administration, but more on the level of, you know, daily life of individuals and communities, well, I mean, they did what they could to protect themselves and their families and their loved ones from disease by all sorts of different, you know, types of precautions and treatments, including, you know, reenacting religious behavior, either, like, you know, the Muslims in Islamic traditions, but also, of course, we have non-Muslim communities in the Ottoman Empire as well. I mean, we have, you know, Christians and Jews and Muslims living side by side. They're all kind of drawing from their religious traditions. At the same time, we have communities that are individuals that were, well, making use of medical traditions, right? So there are tons of different recipes for treatment of plague in Ottoman plague treatises, that we have a very close sense of like what kind of medical substances they were using, how they were trying to treat the sick. And again, interestingly enough, you know, plague, I mean, nobody really knew how to cure the plague, right? Before antibiotics, we're talking about mid-20th century. But there's always an effort to kind of, you know, experiment with like new recipes, use older forms of treatment that were tested and tried. At the same time, just, you know, looking for always new medicines and new methods. In addition to it, we can also mention that people also used what we can perhaps call like spiritual medicine, spiritual methods of treatment. I mean, sometimes religious, sometimes also using talismans, amulets, sometimes using Quranic inscriptions. You know, there's a method, for example, it's a well-known method used against plague, but also other conditions. So you write some Quranic verses on a piece of paper, you put it on a bowl full of water, the ink dissolves. Sometimes they drank that water, sometimes they wash with it. And also you have these, still today, you have still surviving metal bowls that are like healing walls. They have like inscriptions from the Quran and other religious texts about like for verses for healing and whatnot. So yeah, the use of those kinds of methods are also, you know, present in addition to religious, medical, and those other spiritual. What was interesting for me to find in the sources is that sources don't really kind of, you know, differentiate those methods. And they're not saying, oh, this is the right thing to do, never do, you know, those other things. On the contrary, it's like you can mix and match, right? I mean, there are all sorts of, like, there's a wide repertoire of methods that one could use. And perhaps you should do, like, more than one. Like, you pray, but at the same time, you wear your talisman. But at the same time, you use the medicine, right? So all of them combine kind of like in an armor against plague. So that's something that's, I think, significant.
Now I'd like to turn to some of the research you're doing now, which is also related to this, but to what extent was there a medical profession in the Ottoman Empire? I believe you're working on the kind of professionalization of healing, and I was wondering if you could comment a bit on that in, with respect to what we've been speaking about with plague.
Right. I mean, in terms of plague, all right, so let's clarify one thing. Plague, a long-term problem in Ottoman society, as well as everywhere else, was not only something that belonged in the domain of medical practice or professionals, right? I mean, I think that's important to keep in mind. There were multiple individuals or multiple groups of people who claimed to have some prerogative about knowledge about the disease, at least, if not healing. And some individuals who actually claim to have the power to heal. And they're not only medical professionals. For instance, some religious men of religion, from religious scholars, the ulama in the Islamic tradition in the Ottoman Empire, and also some Sufi groups, right? They claim to have mastery over disease, I mean, over plague and other diseases. So, well, and they claim to cure individuals who had, in fact, in some instances, they even, you know, at least in hagiographies, you have accounts of these Sufi masters reviving the dead after plague. So you have these accounts, and I'll leave it at that, right? So, so it's not only medical professionals who claim expertise over plague. And yet, it changes over time, which I think, you know, the process of medicalization, professionalization was taking place in medicine as plague was something that was being rendered a medical phenomenon over time. And I think the two are related. As medical experts professionalized and tried to claim more of the medical market, they try to turn different conditions, including plague, into medical phenomenon. It's a process, and it's difficult to pinpoint exactly when this happens, but I think I see that the process starts somewhere in the late 16th century and it kind of continues after that. It also corresponds to like when the medical profession expands. The first medical school in the Ottoman Empire is 1560s. So toward the end of the era of Suleiman, and also funded by him. The Suleymaniye mosque complex had a medical school, even though there was medical training of sorts, even though we don't know exactly how it looked before that time, from the establishment of the Suleymaniye medical school, you have formal medical education, right? And then those the graduates of the medical school later on kind of try to establish a more professionalized medical establishment. So where does plague belong into this professionalized medical establishment? Well, in the earlier centuries, like before the late 16th century, that was probably somewhere on the margins, as there were fewer medical professionals and there were more individuals claiming to treat the disease, right? But over time, when it got closer to the medical establishment, or when the medical establishment expanded to contain plague, they claim to have greater power or claim over it. But they also, I think it's important that like the medical knowledge about the disease was also diversifying during that time period, as the medical experts were claiming to have more power over it. So it becomes a disease, a medical condition, right? And it's not before. I mean, like before, in the earlier periods, you have all sorts of, the descriptions or like the imagination of plague, not necessarily as a medical phenomenon. You can have like more apocalyptic descriptions of it as something, as a sin, as like more religious descriptions. In some cases, you have like some people talking about plague as a source of martyrdom for Muslims, more like spiritual discussions, some also kind of, relating to astrological phenomena. So you have a very kind of broad spectrum of cultural context in which plague is imagined and discussed, but gradually it's turning into a medical phenomenon. So that's, what I wanted to emphasize.
That's so fascinating. And I think so important to think about how this is not a static phenomenon. It is changing.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So starting to wrap up now, I'd like to think a bit further ahead in time. So you spoke a bit earlier about the European scholarship on the plague, and one of the claims that you contest is this idea that plague somehow went away after the 18th century, or maybe not that simple, but the idea that by ignoring or not paying enough attention to, say, the Ottoman case, I believe you also mentioned the Russian case, Europeanists tend to not think about how plague actually continued in the Ottoman Empire even into the 19th century. So I was curious if you could comment a bit on this, and what do we know about why plague persisted so long, and then what eventually happened to it?
Right. Great question. And, I'm writing a whole book on this, so I can say a few things. So first of all, let's try to correct, the basics and the things that we, again, have heard for so long, but were not correct. So when you look at the European experience of plague during the second pandemic, most scholars so far have accepted or were just feeling comfortable with thinking of either the Plague of London, 1665, or the Plague of Marseille of 1720s as the end of the second pandemic, right? So plague kind of gradually receded. It is true there are no more major outbreaks after these, even though there were outbreaks. So late 17th century, like Northern and Western Europe, and early 18th century Southern and Eastern Europe, plague is gradually, in a process of retreat from Europe. It's true. And when you look at the Ottomanist end of things, Ottomanist historiography, you get a sense that plague stops after 1840s. And in fact, that was even my impression reading the scholarship, because my area of specialization is not the 19th century, so I assumed that's what happened, right? Daniel Panzak, who published this work, Plague, in the Ottoman Empire, La Peste dans l'Empire Ottoman, from 1700 to 1850. So the whole kind of, you know, narrative is that, yes, plague lasted longer in the Ottoman Empire, you know, even after it stopped being a major threat in Europe, but eventually it also dies out in the Ottoman Empire. Why? And the consensus is, of course, because the Ottomans, you know, adopt a quarantine regime in quarantine measures in 1840s. And immediately once they adopt quarantine, plague stops, which is, of course, another misconception and misinformation that we need to think more carefully about. So I've been working on rethinking this narrative about whether plague does actually stop in the Ottoman Empire after 1840. In fact, I realized it was not the case. Plague continues. I mean, it's not as catastrophic as it was before. So there is definitely a gradual decline in mortality. But it doesn't disappear. And in fact, plague is not something that normally disappears from the natural environment, right? And in fact, you know, to what extent quarantine as a regulation was something that can be used to explain the end of it, that's another question. I have doubts about it. But I guess what I'm trying to emphasize is that 1840s is not the end of the second pandemic in the Ottoman Empire. In fact, I see that it continues throughout the rest of the 19th century into the 20th century as well. The Ottoman Empire, of course, you know, the empire ends in 1922, and then you have the modern Republic of Turkey in 1923 and other, you know, sovereign nation states in Anatolia, in Balkans, and in other parts of the Middle East. When you look at the continuation of the outbreaks, well, even in 1920s, you have outbreaks into 1930s. The last one that I found is an outbreak, a very small outbreak that's said to be the last one in this area. It's 1947. So wow. We're talking about mid-20th century.
Post-World War II.
It's fascinating. Like, if we are counting from 1347, though, as now we are learning that that's not even the beginning of the second pandemic, even if we calculated from 1347 to 1947, that's 600 years of continuous plague outbreaks in one part of the world.
It's astounding.
I mean, I think for that reason, I really do believe that the Ottoman records give us a continuous record of the disease like nowhere else in like no other society in the second millennium, basically. So it's like 600 years. So I really think that it's important to understand the Ottoman experience of plague, that's, you know, full 600, to understand like how the disease persists, like what are the natural and social and political and economic factors that contribute to its like long-term sustenance and like amplification, persistence, and you know, how it, when is it enzootic, when it is epidemic, you know, why is there like, you know, change in increase or decrease in mortality rates, like all sorts of biological dimensions of the disease that we cannot get in other places, and I think we can. And also one more thing in addition to it is in fact, we've worked on the history of plague from the European perspective for so long that we want to imagine plague as something that eventually disappears. Even that narrative itself, I think, is inherently biased. Plague is not something that just goes away on its own. Like, it is there to stay. In certain enzootic zones of the world today where you have plague is still there. If it is in the wild rodent communities out in the wild, I mean, as long as humans don't get into close contact with those animals, they're safe. It's not a public health hazard. But the disease, you cannot eradicate. This is not like smallpox where you can, you know, eradicate the disease by vaccinating humans, right? So once it's in the wilderness, there's really nothing much you can do other than just surveillance. In the US, in Western and Southwestern states of the US, in Central Asia, in Madagascar, we had an outbreak a couple of years ago. So plague stays. That's the default behavior of the disease, right? But because we've studied plague for so long, from the Europeanist narrative, with that perspective, that narrative gives us a feeling that humans, over time, conquer the disease. Like, we have better sanitation, better, health, and so eventually it's something that, we grow out of. That, again, at least that's the narrative that you get, which I think needs to be reconsidered.
That's so fascinating and a bit terrifying as well, that it's still with us.
In an age of pandemic, now we realize that we're not free from it, right? I mean, maybe the last 100 years, relatively speaking, we've been in a fortunate trend when you look at the long history of humanity, right? I mean, pandemic disease is another kind of, other climate and environmental disasters. That's something typical for human history. And I mean, like, even before the 19th century, like, when you look at the average life expectancy at birth throughout the world, we're probably talking about something that's, lifespan shorter than 35 to 40 years. We're talking about like 1/5 of infant and child mortality. So with all these, health problems that humanity has lived with throughout centuries, we're now kind of in an unusual time, and we're in this time of forgetting, but now we're remembering, I think. So it's the historical precedent, I think, is important to remember.
Definitely. And I think that brings me quite nicely to what I'd like to close with, which is reflecting on our current moment, on this COVID-19 pandemic, this global crisis. What role and perhaps even responsibility do you think historians of science and medicine, of epidemic disease in the past, what types of responsibilities do they have today?
Right. I mean, first of all, at least from my own experience, I can tell that definitely we're kind of like, we're normally not used to this kind of this level of attention, right? So I guess this is a time for us to be able to communicate beyond our usual readership, which is a good opportunity to reach out and to kind of, correct some of the older narratives. So, but at the same time, I think as a historian, of course, I know that history is not a finished product, right? It's, as some historians say, it's a construction site. We always go back and revisit it and correct it and repair it and fix it and destroy it, right? At the same time, make mistakes. But it's an ongoing process. For me, what is really interesting is how to rethink my historical sources as a historian as we live a pandemic. Honestly, I did not imagine myself that I would... I mean, I guess, we've all known that a pandemic was coming and it could be a major threat for the last couple of decades. There was so much talk about it. But I guess I did not imagine as a historian that I would live this in my lifetime. So it's traumatic, but at the same time, weirdly familiar, at least for someone like me who spent, years reading sources about plague. And so some of it is almost like a deja vu, but at the same time, it helps me to rethink my sources from the emotional vantage point of someone who is in a pandemic. And I also had the COVID infection myself.
Oh, you did? Are you all right?
I'm good. Yeah.
Okay, good.
I mean, mine was one of the mild cases, so it was not a major case. I mean, it wasn't a serious case. So, but also, I mean, I think it just, I learned something as a historian, and I appreciate that.
Well, this has been very fascinating. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Professor Varlick.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you for listening to this 8th episode of the Global History Podcast with Professor Nukit Varlick. As always, if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. If you'd like to listen to the other episodes in this series on global histories of health, medicine, and disease in the early modern world, head over to our website at theglobalhistorypodcast.com or look for the series playlist on Spotify. And last but not least, stay tuned for more episodes, launching weekly on Tuesdays.